Everest while attempting a landing at the airport in Smolensk, Russia. The delegation was on the way to commemorate the 70th anniversary of the Katyn massacre, where the Soviet secret police executed more than 20,000 members of the Polish officer corps. The crash of the airplane was a national tragedy for Poland. Commissions assigned to investigate its causes in Russia and Poland, as well as the available cockpit voice recorder transcripts, determined that pilot error was to blame. However, soon after the crash, prominent politicians in PIS began to question the official narratives emerging from the Russian and Polish investigative commissions. PIS's strategy in the immediate aftermath was to implicate Poland's moderate government as well as the Russian government in a conspiracy to down the aircraft and cover up the crime. Figures associated with PIS have floated about 20 different conspiracy theories about the crash. The mainstream press would denounce the Smolensk sect as conspiracy theorists who were attempting to divide the country, a characterization that those who promulgated the conspiracy theories would in turn use to malign and impugn the press for bias. PIS's ultimate parliamentary success came from how it used these conspiracy theories to undermine faith in the country's primary democratic institutions, the government and the press. Fascist politicians discredit the liberal media for censoring discussion of outlandish right-wing conspiracy theories, which suggests mendacious behavior covered up by the veneer of liberal democratic institutions. Conspiracy theories play to the most paranoid elements of society. In the case of the United States, fear of foreign elements and Islam, as in the birther theory that President Barack Obama was born a Muslim in Kenya. In the case of Hungary and Poland, anti-Semitism and anti-communism. The goal of the conspiracies is to cause widespread mistrust and paranoia, justifying drastic measures such as censoring or shutting down the liberal media and imprisoning enemies of the state. George Soros is an American billionaire philanthropist of Hungarian Jewish origin. Soros's philanthropic organization, the Open Society Foundations, has been deeply involved in democracy-building efforts in more than 100 countries, including in his native Hungary, where his support also led to the founding of Central European University, Hungary's leading university. In 2017, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán claimed that there was a Soros plan to flood Hungary with non-Christian migrants in order to dilute the nation's Christian identity. Orbán's government has launched a campaign against George Soros and his alleged plan, including billboards and television ads targeting Soros, employing what many have perceived to be starkly anti-Semitic representations. There is, of course, no evidence whatsoever that the Jewish financier has any sort of plan to flood Hungary with non-Christian migrants. But the lack of evidence in the mainstream media is taken by the Orbán government to be evidence of Soros's control over it, when in fact it is Orbán who is manipulating reality. Hannah Arendt, perhaps the 20th century's greatest theorist of totalitarianism, gave clear warning of the importance of conspiracy theories in anti-democratic politics. In The Origins of Totalitarianism, she writes, "Mysteriousness, as such, became the first criterion for the choice of topics. The effectiveness of this kind of propaganda demonstrates one of the chief characteristics of modern masses. They do not believe in anything visible, in the reality of their own experience. They do not trust their eyes and ears, but only their imaginations, which may be caught by anything that is at once universal and consistent in itself. What convinces masses are not facts, and not even invented facts, but only the consistency of the system of which they are presumably part. Repetition is only important because it convinces them of consistency in time." Because the audience for conspiracy theories readily discount their own experience, It is often unimportant that the conspiracy theories are demonstrably false. Texas House Bill 45, the American Laws for American Courts Bill, signed into law by Texas Governor Greg Abbott in June 2017, is intended to block Muslims from bringing Sharia law into the state. That Muslims are trying to sneakily transform Texas into an Islamic republic is deeply improbable, as is the hypothesis that President Obama is a secret Muslim pretending to be a Christian in order to overthrow the U.S. government. These conspiracy theories are effective, nevertheless, because they provide simple explanations for otherwise irrational emotions, such as resentment or xenophobic fear in the face of perceived threats. The idea that President Obama is secretly a Muslim pretending to be a Christian in order to overthrow the U.S. government makes rational sense of the irrational feeling of threat many white people had upon his ascension to the presidency. That Muslims are trying to sneak Sharia law into Texas makes rational sense of the feeling of fear caused by a combination of religious nationalists spreading anti-Muslim xenophobia and ISIS propaganda videos of terrorist acts committed on far-off shores. Once a public accepts the comfort of conspiracy thinking as an explanation for irrational fears and resentments, its members will cease to be guided by reason in political deliberation. Spreading wild conspiracy theories benefits fascist movements. And yet, how can this be if reason always wins out in the public square of liberal democracy? Shouldn't liberal democracy promote a full airing of all possibilities, even false and bizarre ones? Because the truth will eventually prevail in the marketplace of ideas? Perhaps philosophy's most famous defense of the freedom of speech was articulated by John Stuart Mill, who defended the ideal in his 1859 work, On Liberty. In Chapter 2 of The Liberty of Thought and Discussion, Mill sets out to establish that silencing any opinion is wrong, even if the opinion is false. To silence a false opinion is wrong because knowledge arises only from the collision of truth with error. In other words, true belief becomes knowledge only by emerging victorious from the din of argument and disagreement and discussion. According to Mill, knowledge emerges only as the result of deliberation with opposing positions, which must occur either with actual opponents or through internal dialogue. Without this process, even true belief remains mere prejudice. We must allow all speech, even defense of false claims and conspiracy theories, because it is only then that we have a chance of achieving knowledge. Whether rightly or wrongly, many associate Mill's On Liberty with the motif of a marketplace of ideas, a realm that, if left to operate on its own, will drive out prejudice and falsehood and produce knowledge. But the notion of a marketplace of ideas, like that of a free market generally, is predicated on a utopian conception of consumers. In the case of the metaphor of the marketplace of ideas, the utopian assumption is that conversation works by exchange of reasons, with one party offering its reasons, which are then countered by the reasons of an opponent, until the truth ultimately emerges. But conversation is not just used to communicate information. Conversation is also used to shut out perspectives, raise fears, and heighten prejudice. The philosopher Ernst Cassirer writes in 1946, remarking on the changes wrought by fascist politics on the German language, "If we study our modern political myths and the use that has been made of them, we find in them, to our great surprise, not only a transvaluation of all our ethical values, but also a transformation of human speech. New words have been coined, and even the old ones are used in a new sense. They have undergone a deep change of meaning. This change of meaning depends upon the fact that these words, which formerly were used in a descriptive, logical, or semantic sense, are now used as magic words that are destined to produce certain effects and to stir up certain emotions. Our ordinary words are charged with meanings, but these newfangled words are charged with feelings and violent passions. The argument for the marketplace of ideas presupposes that words are used only in their descriptive, logical, or semantic sense. But in politics, and most vividly in fascist politics, language is not used simply or even chiefly to convey information, but to elicit emotion. The argument from the marketplace of ideas model for free speech works only if the underlying disposition of the society is to accept the force of reason over the power of irrational resentments and prejudice. If the society is divided, however, then a demagogic politician can exploit the division by using language to sow fear, accentuate prejudice, and call for revenge against members of hated groups. Attempting to counter such rhetoric with reason is akin to using a pamphlet against a pistol. Mill seems to think that knowledge, and only knowledge, emerges from arguments between dedicated opponents. Such a process, according to Mill, destroys prejudice. Mill would surely then be pleased with the Russian television network RT, whose motto is, "Question more." If Mill is correct, RT, which features voices from across the broadest possible political spectrum, from neo-Nazis to far leftists, should be the paradigm source of knowledge production. However, RT's strategy was not devised to produce knowledge. It was rather devised as a propaganda technique to undermine trust in basic democratic institutions. Objective truth is drowned out in the resulting cacophony of voices. The effect of RT, as well as the myriad conspiracy theory-producing websites across the world, including in the United States, has been to destabilize the kind of shared reality that is in fact required for democratic contestation. What did Mill get wrong here? Disagreement requires a shared set of presuppositions about the world. Even dueling requires agreement about the rules. You and I might disagree about whether President Obama's healthcare plan was good policy. But if you suspect that President Obama was an undercover Muslim spy seeking to destroy the United States, and I do not, our discussion will not be productive. We will not be talking about the costs and benefits of Obama's health policy, but rather about whether any of his policies mask a devious anti-democratic agenda. In devising the strategy for RT, Russian propagandists, or political technologists, realized that, with a cacophony of opinions and outlandish possibilities, one could undermine the basic background set of presuppositions about the world that allows for productive inquiry. One can hardly have reasoned discussion about climate policy when one suspects that the scientists who tell us about climate change have a secret pro-homosexual agenda, as for example the evangelical media leader Tony Perkins suggested on an October 29, 2014 edition of his radio program, Washington Watch. Allowing every opinion into the public sphere and giving it serious time for consideration, far from resulting in a process that is conducive to knowledge formation via deliberation, destroys its very possibility. Responsible media in a liberal democracy must, in the face of this threat, try to report the truth and resist the temptation to report on every possible theory, no matter how fantastical, as long as someone advances it. What happens when conspiracy theories become the coin of politics and mainstream media and educational institutions are discredited is that citizens no longer have a common reality that can serve as background for democratic deliberation. In such a situation, citizens have no choice but to look for markers to follow other than truth or reliability. What happens in such cases, as we see across the world, is that citizens look to politics for tribal identifications, for addressing personal grievances, and for entertainment. When news becomes sports, the strong man achieves a certain measure of popularity. Fascist politics transforms the news from a conduit of information and reasoned debate into a spectacle with the strong man as the star. Fascist politics, as we have seen, seeks to undermine trust in the press and universities. But the information sphere of a healthy democratic society does not include just democratic institutions. Spreading general suspicion and doubt undermines the bonds of mutual respect between fellow citizens, leaving them with deep wells of mistrust, not just toward institutions, but also toward one another. Fascist politics seeks to destroy the relations of mutual respect between citizens that are the foundation of a healthy liberal democracy, replacing them ultimately with trust in one figure alone, the leader. When fascist politics is at its most successful, the leader is regarded by the followers as singularly trustworthy. In the 2016 U.S. presidential election, Donald Trump repeatedly and openly lied and openly flouted long sacrosanct liberal norms. The U.S. mainstream media dutifully reported his many lies. His opponent, Hillary Clinton, followed liberal norms of equal respect. Her one violation of these norms, which occurred when she called some of the supporters of her opponent deplorables, was endlessly thrown back in her face. And yet again and again, Americans found Trump to be the more authentic candidate. By giving voice to shocking sentiments that were presumed to be unsuitable for public discourse, Trump was taken to be speaking his mind. This is how, by exhibiting classic demagogic behavior, a politician can come to be seen as the more authentic candidate, even when he is manifestly dishonest. The possibility of this kind of politics arises under certain conditions in a democracy. In another kind of propagandistic, twisted meaning, politicians can convey the message that they are the representative of the common good by explicitly attacking the common good. To see how this perplexing situation is possible, one can look at how in the U.S. political system, these conditions have arisen in the recent past. In Federalist Paper Number 10, James Madison argued that the United States had to take the form of a representative democracy and seek to elect leaders who best represented the values of democracy. An election campaign is supposed to present candidates seeking to show that they have the common interests of all citizens at heart. Two factors have eroded the protections that representative democracy is supposed to provide. First, candidates must raise huge sums to run for office, ever more so since the 2010 Citizens United decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. As a result, they represent the interests of their large donors. However, because it is a democracy, they must also try to make the case that they represent the common interest. They must pretend that the best interests of the multinational corporations that fund their campaigns are also the common interest. Second, some voters do not share democratic values, and politicians must appeal to them as well. When large inequalities exist, the problem is aggravated. Some voters are simply more attracted to a system that favors their own particular religion, race, gender, or birth position. The resentment that flows from unmet expectations can be redirected against minority groups seen as not sharing dominant traditions. Goods that go to them are represented by demagogic politicians in a zero-sum way as taking goods away from majority groups. Some voters see such groups, rather than the behavior of economic elites, as responsible for their unmet expectations. Candidates must attract these voters while appearing not to flout democratic values. As a result, many politicians use coded language to exploit resentment, as in the Republican Party's Southern strategy, in order to avoid the charge of excluding the perspectives of opposing groups. As the infamous Republican political strategist Lee Atwater, then a consultant in Reagan's White House, later the campaign manager for George H.W. Bush's 88 win, explained that racist intent had to be made less overt over time in a 1981 interview with political scientist Alexander Lammas, by 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts you. Backfires. So you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract. Now you're talking about cutting taxes, and all these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and a byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. Tactics like these are not a secret. And for these reasons, U.S. politics has appeared insincere to many voters. And they are sick of it. They crave principled, honest politicians. They want politicians to tell it like it is, and they will seek such candidates even in the absence of a clear set of values they share. But how can politicians signal that they are not hypocritical, especially when voters have grown accustomed to what seems, for both real and contrived reasons, to be a deep stratum of hypocrisy? One way for candidates to address the widespread disgust with hypocrisy is to represent themselves as champions of democratic values. In a democratic culture, such candidates would theoretically be the most attractive. However, this is not a promising strategy in certain political climates. It is difficult to represent oneself as genuinely representing the common interest in an environment of general distrust. It does not appeal to voters who reject democratic values, such as racial or gender equality, or those who simply deny that inequalities exist. And there will be fierce competition for voters who support democratic values between candidates representing themselves as their champions. But there is a way a politician could appear to be sincere without having to vie against other candidates pursuing the same strategy. By standing for division and conflict without apology. Such a candidate might openly side with Christians over Muslims and atheists, or native-born Americans over immigrants, or whites over blacks, or the rich over the poor. They might openly and brazenly lie. In short, one could signal authenticity by openly and explicitly rejecting what are presumed to be sacrosanct political values. Such politicians would be a breath of fresh air in a political culture that seems dominated by real and imagined hypocrisy. They would be especially compelling if they demonstrated their supposed authenticity by explicitly targeting groups that are disliked by the voters they seek to attract. Such open rejection of democratic values would be taken as political bravery, as a signal of authenticity. It was not without justification that Plato saw in democracy's freedoms an allowance for the rise of a skilled demagogue who would take advantage of these freedoms to tear reality asunder, offering himself or herself as a substitute. Ever since Plato and Aristotle wrote on the topic, Political theorists have known that democracy cannot flourish on soil poisoned by inequality. It is not merely that the resentments bred by such divisions are tempting targets for a demagogue. The more important point is that dramatic inequality poses a mortal danger to the shared reality required for a healthy liberal democracy. Those who benefit from inequalities are often burdened by certain illusions that prevent them from recognizing the contingency of their privilege. When inequalities grow particularly stark, these illusions tend to metastasize. What dictator, king, or emperor has not suspected that he was chosen by the gods for his role? What colonial power has not entertained delusions of its ethnic superiority or the superiority of its religion, culture, and way of life? Superiority that supposedly justifies its imperial expansions and conquests. In the antebellum American South, whites believed that slavery was a great gift to those who were enslaved. The harshness of Southern planters to enslaved persons who sought to flee or rebel was in no small part due to their conviction that such behavior revealed lack of gratitude. Extreme economic inequality is toxic to liberal democracy because it breeds delusions that mask reality, undermining the possibility of joint deliberation to solve society's divisions. Those who benefit from large inequalities are inclined to believe that they have earned their privilege, a delusion that prevents them from seeing reality as it is. Even those who demonstrably do not benefit from hierarchies can be made to believe that they do. Hence, the use of racism to ensnare poor white citizens in the United States into supporting tax cuts for extravagantly wealthy whites who happen to share their skin color. Liberal equality means that those with different levels of power and wealth nevertheless are regarded as having equal worth. Liberal equality is, by definition, meant to be compatible with economic inequality. And yet, when economic inequality is sufficiently extreme, the myths that are required to sustain it are bound to threaten liberal equality as well. The myths that arise under conditions of dramatic material inequality legitimize ignoring the proper common referee for public discourse, which is the world. To completely destroy reality, fascist politics replaces the liberal ideal of equality with its opposite, hierarchy. Chapter 5. Hierarchy. The fates of human beings are not equal. Men differ in their states of health and wealth or social status or whatnot. Simple observation shows that, in every such situation, he who is more favored feels the never-ceasing need to look upon his position as in some way legitimate, upon his advantage being deserved, and the other's disadvantage being brought about by the latter's fault. That the purely accidental causes of the difference may be ever so obvious makes no difference. Max Weber, On Law in Economy and Society, 1967. The history of liberal citizenship, of equality under the law, has generally been one of expansion, gradually encompassing people of all races, religions, and genders, to name a few examples. This is true, too, of political philosophy. Influenced, for example, by theorists of disability, philosophers have expanded the notion of human dignity to include those who cannot, under most circumstances, employ their capacity for political judgment. In the 21st century, most liberal thinkers have included a generous recognition of universal human status and dignity to include the ability to feel physical suffering, feel emotions, and express identity and empathy in multiple ways. According to fascist ideology, by contrast, nature imposes hierarchies of power and dominance that are flatly inconsistent with the equality of respect presupposed by liberal democratic theory. Hierarchy is a kind of mass delusion, one readily exploited by fascist politics. A major branch of social psychology, social dominance theory, pioneered by Jim Sidanius and Felicia Prato, studies these delusions under the name of legitimation myths. The opening passages of a 2006 literature review of the previous 15 years of social dominance theory include the claim, "Regardless of a society's form of government, the contents of its fundamental belief system, or the complexity of its social and economic arrangements, human societies tend to organize as group-based social hierarchies in which at least one group enjoys greater social status and power than other groups." Fascist ideology, then, takes advantage of a human tendency to organize society hierarchically, and fascist politicians represent the myths that legitimize their hierarchies as immutable facts. Their principal justification of hierarchy is nature itself. For the fascist, the principle of equality is a denial of natural law, which sets certain traditions, those of the more powerful, over others. The natural law allegedly places men over women, and members of the chosen nation of the fascist over other groupings. Nature is repeatedly invoked in fascist writing. On March 21, 1861, Alexander H. Stephens, the vice president of the Confederacy, delivered an address that has come to be known as the Cornerstone Speech. In it, he denounces the principles of liberty and equality enshrined in the U.S. Constitution as violations of the laws of nature. "Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea of equality. Its foundations are laid, its cornerstone rests, upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery's subordination to the superior race is his natural and normal condition." The Cornerstone Speech makes vivid the characteristically fascist logic that liberal democratic principles are in conflict with nature and must therefore be abandoned. I recollect of once having heard a gentleman from one of the northern states, of great power and ability, announce in the House of Representatives with imposing effect that we of the South would be compelled, ultimately, to yield upon this subject of slavery, that it was as impossible to war successfully against a principle in politics as it was in physics or mechanics, that the principle would ultimately prevail, that we, in maintaining slavery as it exists with us, were warring against a principle founded in nature, the principle of the equality of men. The reply I made to him was that upon his own grounds we should ultimately succeed, and that he and his associates in this crusade against our institutions would ultimately fail. The truth announced that it was as impossible to war successfully against a principle in politics as it was in physics and mechanics, I admitted, but told him that it was he and those acting with him who were warring against a principle. They were attempting to make things equal, which the Creator had made unequal. The Confederacy, Stevens declares, is founded upon principles in strict conformity with the laws of nature, which are the real cornerstone in our new edifice. Stevens denounces those who would deny the inequality of racial inferiority as fanatics who reject the eternal principles of truth. The Confederacy, like Hitler's Reich, was built to defend the aristocratic principle in nature, the principle of racial hierarchy. In the university, there remain powerful voices who call for reasoned discourse about genetic differences between races in such aspects as intelligence or propensity to violence, and in them we find a clear echo of Stevens's condemnation of abolitionists as irrational fanatics for their firm belief in racial equality. In his March 2018 article for The Guardian, The Unwelcome Revival of Race Science, Gavin Evans describes how race science is leaching into mainstream discourse via figures such as the political scientist Charles Murray and the Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker. According to Evans, in 2005, Pinker began popularizing the view that Ashkenazi Jews are innately particularly intelligent, a view that Evans describes as the smiling face of race science. The claim that Ashkenazi Jews are innately particularly intelligent invites the reader to draw conclusions about other groups and their innate intelligence. In a 2007 piece for the online venue The Edge, Pinker decries how political correctness has prevented researchers from studying dangerous ideas, including, do women, on average, have a different profile of aptitudes and emotions than men? And are Ashkenazi Jews, on average, smarter than Gentiles because their ancestors were selected for the shrewdness needed in money lending? And do African American men have higher levels of testosterone on average than white men? The concern about this kind of writing is that it presents those who seek a natural source for inequality as brave truth seekers, driven by reason to reject the heart's plea for equality. This research has proven to be suspect at best. And yet, the search for the natural source of inequality that Stevens pointed to as fact somehow continues, grail-like. Fascists argue that natural hierarchies of worth, in fact, exist, and that their existence undermines the obligation for equal consideration. One sees a valuation of this kind in the words of the many white supporters of Donald Trump in the 2016 U.S. presidential election, who regularly spoke of their disdain for supposedly undeserving recipients of U.S. governmental largesse in the form of health care, by which they often meant their black fellow citizens. In his run for the presidency, Trump exploited the lengthy history of ranking Americans into a hierarchy of worth by race, the deserving versus the undeserving. When pressed by journalists to justify a distinction between the deserving and the undeserving, Americans who use such vocabulary reach in the first instance for the language of hard-working versus lazy, rather than for the language of racial distinction. But this hardly justifies the division of fellow citizens into such categories. First, in the United States, racism has often taken the form of associating blackness with laziness. Such language has always been a code for division by racial hierarchy. Second, it betrays confusion about the concept of liberal democracy to measure worthiness by a supposed capacity for hard work. It is no part of liberal democratic theory that basic equal respect is won by hard work. The idea behind liberal democracy is that all of us are equally deserving of the basic goods of society. Some would argue for the existence of inherent differences between groups of people along lines of intelligence and self-control, and still claim to value equal dignity for all. Nevertheless, history gives us salient examples of the difficulty of believing in systematic group differences while upholding the equal treatment of others. In his 1920 essay, Of the Ruling of Men, W.E.B. Du Bois writes about the failure to give women equal voice in the determination of policy. Women have been excluded from modern democracy because of the persistent theory of female subjection and because it was argued that their husbands or other male folks would look to their interests. Now, manifestly, Most husbands, fathers, and brothers will, so far as they know how or as they realize women's needs, look after them. We have but to view the unsatisfactory relations of the sexes the world over and the problem of children to realize how desperately we need this excluded wisdom. Such examples suggest the difficulty of maintaining an ethic of equal worth in the presence of a belief in genetic group differences in cognitive abilities or the capacity to control one's own actions. No one is forced by a confrontation with reality into believing in these kinds of hierarchical differences between, for example, genders or racial or ethnic groups. There is no persuasive evidence for such hierarchies, despite centuries of attempts to establish them by religious edict or scientific investigation. Those who strenuously argue for racial hierarchies of intelligence or the capacity for self-control while denying any interest in illiberal moral or political consequences tend to be misguided. Establishing hierarchies of worth is of course a means of obtaining and retaining power, a kind of power that liberal democracy attempts to delegitimize. On this point, there are critiques of liberal ideals from both the traditional left and the traditional right. Leftist critiques of liberalism point out its supposed failure to account for structural historical inequalities, in that the practice of liberalism does not typically include remedies for past injustice. Leftist critics of liberalism also argue that the liberal ideals of equality and freedom can be used to entrench the power of dominant groups. For example, it can be argued that ways to remedy entrenched structural injustice, say, affirmative action programs, violate liberal ideals of equal treatment. Critiques of liberalism from the right have a different flavor. Right-wing critics warn that liberal equality can be used by marginalized groups as a weapon to displace the privileged status of dominant groups and their traditions. Both left-wing and right-wing critiques of liberalism focus on the fact that liberal ideals ignore differences in power. Leftist critics argue that by doing so, liberal ideals entrench pre-existing inequalities. Rightist critics argue that by ignoring differences in power, liberalism makes dominant groups susceptible to having their privileged status overturned by forced, and therefore unjust, power sharing. We find the latter critique of liberalism explicit in Hitler's writings, as well as the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. The Protocols, recall, is a forgery that is written like an instruction manual by the Elders of Zion, supposed leaders among Jews, to other Jews, to take over and dominate the world on behalf of the Jewish people. It begins by instructing the reader to infect the opponent with the idea of freedom, so-called liberalism. According to the Protocols, liberalism weakens the opponent, here the Christian, by drawing Christians into recognizing the equal rights of Jews. If Christians accept liberalism, they will be led to give equal respect and equal recognition to other religious groups, thereby ceding their dominant traditional position. Political freedom is an idea but not a fact. This idea one must know how to apply whenever it appears necessary with this bait of an idea to attract the masses of the people to one's party for the purpose of crushing another who is in authority. This task is rendered easier if the opponent has himself been infected with the idea of freedom, so-called liberalism, and, for the sake of an idea, is willing to yield some of his power. It is precisely here that the triumph of our theory appears. The slackened reins of government are immediately, by the law of life, caught up and gathered together by a new hand, because the blind might of the nation cannot for one single day exist without guidance, and the new authority merely fits into the place of the old, already weakened by liberalism. In the statement, "Political freedom is an idea, but not a fact," the purported authors of the protocols, echo the theme of Stevens's cornerstone speech, that political freedom, and hence political equality, is an illusion, an impossibility, given that nature requires one group to lead and dominate. The protocols suggests spreading the myth of political freedom, or liberalism, to members of dominant groups. By accepting the myth of political freedom, those in power will grant equal status to those who lack it. But since the law of life, that is, nature, demands that one group rule, once Jews are granted some of the power by the dominant Christians, they can then seize all of the power from them. Equality, according to the fascist, is the Trojan horse of liberalism. The part of Odysseus can be variously played by Jews, by homosexuals, by Muslims, by non-whites, by feminists, etc. Anyone spreading the doctrine of liberal equality is either a dupe, infected by the idea of freedom, or an enemy of the nation who is spreading the ideals of liberalism, only with devious and indeed illiberal aims. The fascist project combines anxiety about loss of status for members of the true nation with fear of equal recognition of hated minority groups. For the 20th century Ku Klux Klan, Jews were often perceived as the force behind black racial equality. Jews sought to advance black equality in order to dilute pure white blood and undermine the white Christian ethnostate. As the Nazi ideologue Alfred Rosenberg writes in a 1923 commentary on The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, it is well known that Jews of all kinds pretend to fight for freedom and peace day after day. Their speakers drip with humanity and love of mankind, as long as Jewish interests are thereby promoted. In Nazi ideology, Jews operate with the same hierarchical views of nature as Nazis do, but use the universal principles of liberal democracy as a facade to advance it. It is classic fascist politics, as we have seen, to represent the actual defenders of liberal democracy as defending its ideals only in the service of undermining them. According to fascists, liberals and Marxists, or cultural Marxists, advance the ideals of equality and liberty, spreading their ideas as infections to members of the dominant group, which leads them to willingly hand over their power. In the case of women's equality, acceptance of liberal ideals leads to the destruction of the virtuous patriarchal society that is the basis of fascist myth. Lindbergh's America First movement repudiated liberal ideals as leading to the pollution of the pure blood of the white nation via immigration. In the case of contemporary Russia, and much of the U.S. Christian right, liberal democracy leads to the legitimation of immigration and the supposed introduction of mass rape by immigrants, and to the acceptance of homosexuality together with its supposedly attendant sin of degeneracy. Hierarchy benefits fascist politics in another way. Those who are accustomed to its benefits can be easily led to view liberal equality as a source of victimization. Those who benefit from hierarchy will adopt a myth of their own superiority, which will occlude basic facts about social reality. They will distrust pleas for tolerance and inclusion made by liberals on the grounds that these pleas are masks for power grabs by other groups. Fascist politics feeds off the sense of aggrieved victimization caused by loss of hierarchical status. Empires in decline are particularly susceptible to fascist politics because of this sense of loss. It is in the very nature of empire to create a hierarchy. Empires legitimize their colonial enterprises by a myth of their own exceptionalism. In the course of decline, the population is easily led to a sense of national humiliation that can be mobilized in fascist politics to serve various purposes. During the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the Ottoman Empire experienced a tremendous collapse, losing more than 400,000 square miles of territory in Africa and Europe, including Libya, Albania, Macedonia, Bosnia, Herzegovina, and Crete. The Ottoman Sultanate was overthrown in 1908, and in 1913 the empire was taken over by extremist ultranationalists who preached a vision of a completely mythic, pure ethnic Turkish past that was placed in threat by the presence of non-Turkish, non-Muslim minorities. The mythology here is particularly extreme, as the Ottoman Empire's home of modern-day Turkey was the site of one of the world's most powerful and longest-lasting Christian empires, Byzantium. They were able to exploit the sense of humiliation and resentment and loss of territory to bring about, in the second decade of the 20th century, one of the more horrific crimes in history, the massacre of the Armenian Christian population of Turkey. In Why Now? It's the Empire, Stupid, a June 2016 article in The Nation, the NYU historian Greg Grandin argues that Donald Trump's politics is effective in the context of the 2016 campaign because it comes at a time of decline for the American empire. We are witnessing the passing of the era after the end of the Cold War, in which the United States reigned supreme in the world as the only remaining superpower. In the article, he argues that an empire gives rise among its citizens to a comforting myth of superiority, thereby concealing the various social and structural problems that otherwise would lead to political difficulties. With its demise, the citizens of a once powerful empire must confront the fact that their exceptionalism was a myth. Grandin writes that beginning in 2008, about when Barack Obama won the presidential election, the safety valve of empire closed, gummed up by the catastrophic war in Iraq combined with the 2008 financial crisis, because Obama came to power in the ruins of neoliberalism and neoconservatism, empire was no longer able to dilute the passions, satisfy the interests, and unify the divisions. When imperial hierarchy collapses and social reality is laid bare, hierarchical sentiment in the home country tends to arise as a mechanism to preserve the familiar and comforting illusion of superiority. Fascist politics thrives off the resulting sense of aggrieved loss and victimization that results from the ever more tenuous and difficult struggle to defend a sense of cultural, ethnic, religious, gendered, or national superiority. Chapter 6. Victimhood. In fascist politics, the opposing notions of equality and discrimination get mixed up with each other. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 made the newly emancipated black Americans of the South into U.S. citizens and protected their civil rights. It was passed by the Senate and the House on March 14, 1866. Later that month, President Andrew Johnson vetoed the Civil Rights Act on the grounds that this law establishes for the security of the colored race safeguards which go infinitely beyond any that the general government have ever provided for the white race. As W.E.B. Du Bois notes, Johnson perceived minimal safeguards at the start of a path toward future black equality as discrimination against the white race. Today, white Americans wildly overestimate the extent of U.S. progress toward racial equality over the past 50 years. Economic inequality between black and white Americans is roughly at the point it was during Reconstruction. For every $100 the average white family has accumulated, the average black family has just $5. And yet, as Jennifer Richeson, Michael Krauss, and Julian Rucker have shown in their 2017 paper, Americans Misperceive Racial Economic Equality, white American citizens are widely ignorant of this fact, believing that racial economic inequality has dramatically narrowed. 45% of President Donald Trump's supporters believe that whites are the most discriminated against racial group in America. 54% of Trump's supporters believe that Christians are the most persecuted religious group in America. There is a crucial distinction, of course, between feelings of resentment and depression and genuine inequality and discrimination. There is a long history of social psychological research about the fact that increased representation of members of traditional minority groups is experienced by dominant groups as threatening in various ways. More recently, a growing body of social psychological evidence substantiates the phenomenon of dominant group feelings of victimization at the prospect of sharing power equally with members of minority groups. A great deal of recent attention has been paid in the United States to the fact that around 2050, the United States will become a majority-minority country, meaning that whites will no longer be a majority of Americans. Taking advantage of the salience of this information, some social psychologists have tested what happens when white Americans are primed with it. In a 2014 study, the psychologists Maureen Craig and Jennifer Richeson found that simply making salient the impending national shift to a majority-minority country significantly increased politically unaffiliated white Americans' support for right-wing policies. For example, reading about an impending racial shift of the country from majority white to majority non-white made white American subjects less inclined to support affirmative action, more inclined to support restrictions on immigration, and, perhaps surprisingly, more likely to support race-neutral conservative policies such as increasing defense spending. Summarizing this research in a forthcoming review article, Maureen Craig, Julian Rucker, and Jennifer Richeson write, "This growing body of work finds clear evidence that white Americans, i.e. the current racial majority, experience the impending majority-minority shift as a threat to their dominant social, economic, political, and cultural status. This feeling of threat can be marshaled politically as support for right-wing movements. This dialectic is far from native to the United States. It is rather a general feature of group psychology. The exploitation of the feeling of victimization by dominant groups at the prospect of sharing citizenship and power with minorities is a universal element of contemporary international fascist politics. In the face of discrimination, oppressed groups throughout history have risen up in movements that proclaimed pride for their endangered identities. In Western Europe, the Jewish nationalism of the Zionist movement arose as a response to toxic antisemitism. In the United States, Black nationalism arose as a response to toxic racism. In their origins, these nationalist movements were responses to oppression. Anti-colonialist struggles typically take place under the banner of nationalism. For example, Mahatma Gandhi employed Indian nationalism as a tool against British rule. This kind of nationalism, the nationalism that arises from oppression, is not fascist in origin. These forms of nationalism, in their original formations, are equality-driven nationalist movements. In colonialism, the imperial nation typically presents itself as the bearer of universal ideals. For example, British colonialists in Kenya presented Christianity as the universal ideal, and the many local tribal religions as primitive and savage. In part a response to this religious oppression, the Mau Mau rebellion against Britain valorized the traditional Gikuyu religion. Mau Mau rebels took an oath to Ngai, the Gikuyu god. The Mau Mau colonialist struggle used nationalist religious ideals to fight colonialism. But the goal of the Mau Mau struggle was not to fight for the superiority of the Gikuyu religious traditions over the British religious traditions. The goal was rather to fight for the equality of the Gikuyu traditions against the British demonization of them as forms of primitive savagery. To do so, it was necessary to elevate these traditions, to hold them as sacrosanct and special, not as a means of repudiating the value of British traditions, but rather as a means to emphasize a demand for equal respect.